This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will talk with Don McLean, the remarkable singer and songwriter. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and his American Pie from 1971 was ranked the fifth most prominent song of the 20th century by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Don McLean is coming to Baton Rouge, and we'll talk with him about his appearance here a week from Friday. Also, his career, which now spans nearly a half century. It all started at Villanova, where he was a classmate of Jim Croce. Alicia Long, LSU history professor, is with us to discuss what's going on in Baton Rouge and the significance of the vote yesterday by the Metro Council, 8-4 against the Fairness Ordinance. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we start our day with Don McLean, one of the most enduring singer-songwriters in the world today, forever associated with classic hits such as American Pie and Vincent. And he is coming our way, as in a week from Friday, the 22nd, at the River Center. The remarkable Don McLean will be on stage in Baton Rouge. Don, it's always a pleasure to talk with somebody of your significance in the industry, and there's no doubt that you have a body of work that ranks with among the greats. Let's start with how it began. You became famous and successful at a relatively young age, but it didn't come easy for you, did it?
Primarily, it was because record companies, you know, liked the fact that they like my singing. They like some of the songs that I wrote, but the songs were all very different. And the first album I made, Tapestry, we couldn't get someone to back it, so we got some money and started recording it anyway. And they kept saying, "Well, you should re-record it, or you know, we don't like this song, but we do like that song." And ironically, two songs, Castles in the Air and End I Love You So, came off that record. I didn't have the hits of those, but I did have a hit of Castles in the Air 10 years later when I re-recorded it, so they may have been right about that. But And I Love You So was recorded by lots and lots of people through the years and still gets recordings by major people. But so there was good stuff on there, but it was the variety of songs, and that's still, I think, what I do. You know, I like many different styles and many different ways of writing a song, so that's why, you know, Castles in the Air is so different from American Pie or Vincent.
I like your version of I Love You So better than Perry Como's, but his was a number one hit.
Yeah, that was his million seller for him at the end of his career, and it ended up being recorded. Lots of people recorded it before Como, which really surprised me. All the Johnny Mathis and all the pop singers did it, but then he did it and he had a big hit with it, and everybody else started doing it after that.
That first album, Tapestry, 1969, you recorded it in Berkeley, I believe.
Yes. Downtown occupied Berkeley, as they used to say. We would have confrontations with the police getting to the studio to cut the record. I wouldn't, but you know, guys would get gassed coming to the studio.
I don't know if it's an urban legend, but supposedly it was rejected 72 times before.
Not 72, probably about 30 times.
30 times, but you stayed the course, and those works you mentioned. And I Love You
well,
So.
I didn't have any other options, so there really wasn't a failure option for me. I really didn't. I didn't plan to ever change my course of my life. You know, I wasn't somebody who said, "Oh well, you know, if this doesn't work, I'll go to work for somebody in my family." You know, which I probably could have, but there was no chance that I was ever going to change course because I just wanted to get the damn thing out, you know. I really didn't think I would have any kind of commercial success at all. So the fact that Castles in the Air and End I Love You So got on the charts right away absolutely shocked me. I was really shocked because I never dreamed that that was possible. I just wanted to make an album to let the world know I existed, you know, once, way back when, never dreaming that so many other things would happen. And I had very, very low goals for myself. If I could just make enough money to have a little house somewhere, maybe a couple of horses and a dog, you know, I would have been pretty happy.
Well, before Berkeley, you went to Villanova, and
right.
I think one of your classmates was another amazing singer-songwriter, Jim Croce.
Yeah, Jim Croce was an upperclassman. I was just a freshman and lived off campus. And somehow or other, Jim Croce was, as we used to say, a big man on campus. You know, he was in all the folk groups, and he was in lots of other activities and so on. He was very straight-laced, and I think he was studying psychology. And I think he went on to get a master's in psychology before he finally started doing what he really was meant to do, which was to become Jim Croce. So I left school, and after 4 months, and he continued on, and I would see him from time to time, and he never was as happy. He was always brooding, I think because he didn't like the direction his life was going. He really wanted to make music, and so finally he did. Around 1971 or so, he came out with an album and started making hits, and he would have made a lot of them because he knew how to do that.
And then he died a couple of years later, tragically,
correct,
in Louisiana.
Didn't know that.
Well,
he didn't have good luck. You know, I had an old lady friend of mine. She said, I'd rather be lucky than rich. And I think that's true.
That's true. Well, your most famous song is one of the most famous of all time. And it's also about a plane crash, 1959, February 3rd. Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, J.P. Richardson, they die in a plane crash. And the song American Pie captures that moment in time like no other piece of work since 1959. What did you have going through your artistic soul when you recorded this on the 26th day of May, 1971?
Well, I have sometimes complicated ideas for songs, and that's part of the reason why I haven't ever settled on one commercial style of music and just went and had one, you know, successful record after another, which is really the way that you do it in this business. And James Taylor is a perfect example of an excellent artist who stays within certain parameters, and you always know that it's him, and the songs are somewhat similar. I do the complete opposite, you know, and that's why I'm not as successful as James Taylor. But what I try to do is create songs that are their ideas first. So the idea for American Pie was, number one, I wanted an inclusive song, a big song, that all the other songs in my show would lead to. In other words, this is Americana. So that was the first concept. I wanted a big, conclusive song for my performances. And then I started thinking about it. Well, I didn't want to do any of the kind of Woody Guthrie type things or any kind of, you know, flag waving thing. But I did want to talk about the country and music. And then I realized that politics, and at least this is my theory, that politics and music flow parallel. This may not be true, but this is the theory of the song, and move forward. So that there was a political and a musical connection as the song progresses. And you can feel the progression of the song, but yet it's not saying, it doesn't say, and in 1980 this happened, and in 19, you know, that kind of thing. So I had to, and each time I would try to find a new lyric style to write the song in. So each song has a specific lyric style that I invent. So it's a whole little world that I get into, which is actually refers back to my childhood, I think, when I spent a lot of time with the record player and the radio and the television. I was a pretty ill a lot when I was young, and so I stayed really out of the educational system enough to make me slightly nuts like I am.
Well, I think you were 13 in 1959 when Buddy Holly's plane went down, and you, I presume, were in New Rochelle, New York. What do you remember?
That's correct.
What do you remember about that day?
Well, I was a paper boy. It's the only job I've ever had. And the song is somewhat biographical as well. So I was delivering the local paper, which was called the Standard Star. And I went out and cut open the papers. They would throw a bundle of them in front of your house. And there it was on the front page. And I was really a big Buddy Holly fan. And Buddy Holly had been off the charts for about 2 years. So he wasn't, and that's the reason, one of the reasons why he took that tour, was that money was being denied to him, pressure was being placed on him in order to return to the fold and start being Buddy Holly and the Crickets again. And Buddy Holly just wanted to be on his own. And he'd married a Spanish lady and moved to New York City in Greenwich Village. And they had a baby coming and no money. So he had to take this tour, which he may or may not have taken otherwise. But apparently he went and stayed behind to do his laundry and flew ahead to catch up with the tour. And that's how he got killed. And I learned that fact from Phil Everly when I was singing at the Newport Folk Festival in 1969. And that was one of the things that started me thinking about this idea again and how to grab hold of it. And I suddenly used the Buddy Holly story, really, to begin the song. And that song actually was the reason why the Buddy Holly movie was made, according to the people that made it who came to visit me. And later on, the song caused a lot of stations to start to play music from the 50s. And 60s. And so it did a lot of things that I don't normally get credit for, but I happen to know that that's what the song did. So it really brought back a lot of that music.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 2001, American Pie was voted number 5 in a poll of the 365 songs of the 20th century that was compiled by the Recording Industry Association of America and the National Endowment for the Arts. It is a song you'll always be synonymous with, but you have a body of work that is impressive, even if American Pie had never been recorded. Are you okay with the fact that this is the song that will be in the first line of your obit?
Well, whether I am or not, that's how it's going to be. And I've always realized that you have to play the hand you're dealt. So I certainly remember how poor I was, you know, before I wrote that song. And I realize what a wonderful life I've had because of that song and the albums I've made that have sold pretty well and the audience that's come to see me all over the world for all these 40 years. And they do come to hear American Pie, and they do come to hear Vincent, and they do come to hear Crying, and they do come to hear And I Love You So and Castles in the Air and songs from the American Pie album and so on and so forth. But they don't come just for one song. Otherwise, you know, they could just buy the record. So I've been very fortunate in that sense, you know. But I have no regrets, and I have no problem. I like being who I am, and I like what I do. And I think that American Pie perfectly represents the unusual way that I go about writing songs, so that it's an excellent example, probably one of the best, of the kind of fusion music that I make, which is basically a fusion of old-fashioned popular music, rock and roll, and folk music. Rock and roll as I knew it in the 1950s, simple three-chord rock and roll. American Pie has an opening, which was with a piano, which might be considered, in a popular song, something called a vamp, which are the first lines before the song begins, usually on a piano, and then the song starts.
We're listening to the distinctive voice of Don McLean, and we shall return after this brief pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we resume our conversation with the remarkable Don McLean, who continues to mesmerize audiences with his gifts to this day, and he will be with us on August 22nd at the River Center. Tickets are still available if you'd like to see this remarkable singer-songwriter who is one of the best this nation has produced. Don McLean, American Pie. What is the song really about?
Well, it's a rock and roll dream, really, so I never talk about the lyrics because that would be specific, and therefore, and I'm not being cute about it. That's the reason why I don't talk about them. But it actually spoofs a lot of songs, like the Paul is Dead thing and the what was the one that Carly sang? You're So Vain, you know, mm-hmm. Who's it written about? You know, that kind of stuff. So it's sort of, there's a little mockery in American Pie if you dig in there a little bit.
Well, the song Vincent, I think that if you were to ask most critics of music, they would say that this one perhaps is your greatest work. It's a pretty good song too, isn't it?
Well, it's a hard song to sing, and there are a lot of images, and it's the kind of thing that people really don't tackle too often on The Voice or any of these shows because it requires control. And one of the things that I learned when I was young, or wanted to learn, and this song, by the way, is very much in the straight old-fashioned pop music vein, Vincent. Chet Atkins loved it. He used to play it every night in his shows, and he was wonderfully supportive of me. And by the way, he's the reason Como recorded And I Love You So. But in any case, one of the things I tried to learn when I was young is I would take long walks, and I would sing popular songs to myself, and I would try to control my voice and learn to control a very slow song. And it's very hard to do. Like Roberta Flack can do that. I mean, she does it brilliantly. And that takes tremendous effort and study to learn to do that. But I loved trying to learn to do it, you know, and that's what's required to sing that song.
You mentioned Roberta Flack. Is it true that Killing Me Softly with his song is based on her reaction to you?
Well, that is not her reaction to me, but Lori Lieberman's story about the creation of that song has to do with her. That is Lori Lieberman seeing me at the Troubadour sing a song called Empty Chairs, which I usually sing in concert and will probably sing in Baton Rouge. And she wrote a poem about me, and she had two songwriters named Charles Gimbel and Norman Gimbel and Charles Fox who were writing songs for her. And so they used her feelings in writing the lyrics to the song.
Don McLean is in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and he has produced a catalog of classics. How often do you tour?
I'm on the road a lot. You know, my children are both grown. I've got a girl and a boy. They both finished college. My daughter's married, and she has a little daughter. And my son just got out of college, and he's actually going to be traveling with me this week to New Mexico, where I'm singing for two nights. Anyone can go on the internet and type any artist name and then the word Polestar after it, Polestar, and find out what shows they're doing. So that's fun to do, and you'll see that I've got about 25 shows ahead of me, and then a European tour will in May and June of next year, which will probably be another 28 shows, and there'll be more shows next year which haven't been logged on to Polestar. So that's about how much I work.
It's a great compliment that so many other artists have taken to your work. When you hear somebody, let's say like Madonna, do American Pie, does that please you?
Well, it absolutely delighted me and still does. And it's, you know, it was a small blip on her screen, but she did do a movie which had the song in it and then released it as a single in two different ways and a great video, and there was a lot of fun around the whole thing. But what amazed me when that was all going on was how much abuse she was taking. And I still follow her a little bit once in a while and see they constantly abuse her. And she continues to come on with success. So she's really one of the great stars of all time. And to have her, you know, move out of her comfort zone, which is to usually have songs written for her or write them with somebody and do a song like that, was unusual, and I'm very grateful that she did that.
Well, Don McLean will be coming our way in a few days, Friday the 22nd at the River Center. And before we part, you're born right at the end of World War II. Your most notable song is about 1959. And in those years, since you became a superstar in 71, you've dabbled a bit in politics. How do you think our country has changed during your life?
Well, there are two things. I never saw a black face when I grew up unless it was a garbage man. And we've totally, the whole country has changed in the sense that we have really made great strides, I think, in getting along and in representing all the different kinds of people that are Americans, which is, it took a very long time to do that. The other thing was that sportsmanship has deteriorated tremendously in America, and I think it's a bad sign spiritually of the country, winning at all costs, the sort of the John McEnroe. I think he did a lot of damage to sportsmanship, and so that's something that we wouldn't have tolerated in the 1950s growing up. You know, if you won, you won, and you were gracious about it. And if you lost, you figured out how to win the next time. Didn't go around screaming and yelling. So I think we've gone the wrong way in that sense. And I say that because it reflects the attitude toward everything. Politics, the way we treat other countries, you know, in a dismissive way sometimes, so on and so forth. And I just think that the pressure placed on, you know, kids to always win. Listen, if people look up to me now in some small way and think that I'm successful, which I am, I was a joke for years in New Rochelle. You know, that guy who played the guitar, you know, and was doing another show, does he think he is, you know, this, that, and the other thing. So, you know, you don't win a lot of times. You know, you lose for a long time. And that teaches you, when you do finally win, that maybe you're going to lose again and you're going to learn how to win again instead of always, you know, just crumbling. So this is what's so great about Muhammad Ali. I mean, he was always, he took defeat and he continued on. He was a great example, really, of many things. Anyway,
A great winner and a great loser is Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, he was. He'd say, well, it's just another experience in life. And, you know, he evolved and grew and in the right way and in the right direction. And I sometimes do not see that in America now because we've become too corporate, I think. And, you know, you lose the local color and you lose the well, even everyone trying to sound the same because of television and so on. So,
well, since
the way the streets are laid out, you know, these big highways that are not friendly to walking around, you know, a lot of our cities now and smaller cities too, you know, you really can't walk, it's all for cars and stuff. That's not really about people, you know, so it's about corporations and commerce. And so these are, when I was a kid, you know, everyone knew my name.
Well, Robin Williams proved this week, Don, that you can be successful and be terribly unhappy. Are you a happy man?
You know, I'm a miserable man in some ways, but I'm always happy in my misery, and I think there's something to be said for that. You know, that if there's something that bothers me, or if I'm worried about something, I'm excited about the goal that I'm after, or the song I'm writing, or the next job I'm going to do. In fact, my wife said to me, "I can't believe you've been doing this for 45 years, and you still get excited when you get a good job." You know, but I do. I love it. You know, and so you have to. You really can't understand what would make a fellow like Robin Williams so unhappy that he would do that. My feeling is that a lot of times it would have been a big mistake. He might have said, you know, there have been stories of people who've jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge who survived, and halfway down they said, "Oh, man, what did I do?" You know, so if you can't take it back.
Well, thank you for joining us today and sharing your story. It is a remarkable one, and this is one performer Baton Rouge will be proud to host, and we look forward to seeing you Friday the 22nd.
Well, I enjoy talking to you very much. Thank you.
Take care. Don McLean.
What you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free, they would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now, for they could not love you.
And our guest now, in a tough act to follow, Alicia Long is in studio, professor of history at Louisiana State University, and she specializes in the history of our state and the histories of race, gender, and sexuality in New Orleans and the South. She's the author of The Great Southern Babylon, Sex, Race, and Respectability in New Orleans, 1865 to 1920. And today, 94 years since 1920. We're weighing the vote yesterday by the Metro Council in Baton Rouge, 8-4 against a fairness ordinance. Those voting in favor see Denise Marcel, John Delgado, Chandler Loop, and Donna Collins Lewis. And those voting against the fairness ordinance, Trey Welch, Shauna Banks Daniel, Scott Wilson, Ronnie Edwards, Buddy Amoroso, Joel Boy, Tara Wicker, and Ryan Heck. And good to visit with you, Dr. Long.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Long is a native of Knoxville, Tennessee, so she is a daughter of the South, PhD from the University of Delaware, and she's taught at LSU for 7 years. As far as the historical context of this, and we've discussed it on the show with various guests as far as how gay people, and there's no doubt this was about gay people, how they've been discriminated against in this state, perhaps in this city, and how it compares to the racial discrimination that's taken place through the centuries against black people. You, as a historian, what's your take on it?
Well, I heard a couple of people yesterday on your show make the claim that there's no significant or real comparison to be made between the LGBT civil rights movement and the civil rights movement for African Americans. And I just wanted to disagree about that on historical terms in three ways. And there's no doubt that the African American civil rights movement has gone on much longer than the LGBT movement. But in the post-World War II period, when African Americans are beginning to make very significant gains at the level of governmental policy and judicial decision making, this is the very same moment that LGBT people, gay men first, start to organize for their own rights. For instance, in 1950, the Mattachine Society was formed. It was one of the first gay rights organizations. And they very specifically developed their program around what they were watching in the African American civil rights movement. So they certainly saw a connection. I would also say there's a sort of substantive comparison to be made in terms of the kind of legal and unofficial harassment that was meted out to African Americans in terms of segregation. And LGBT people. Let me just give you one example from a 1959 report to the Metro Council in New Orleans at the time, where they commissioned a report about what we do about gay people in our community. And here's a quote. From the report writer, persons who don't hesitate to rent their premises to individuals with all the appearances, mannerism, and repulsive conduct of sex deviants, which is what homosexuals were called at the time, should take a new look at the sordid consequences that stem from the acts of such person. And it concludes, don't rent or lease to sex deviants. And so I was going over this material and was very struck by the conversation mm-hmm. going on in Baton Rouge. And then finally, I would say there's a connection among individuals with the civil rights movement. I'll just use the single example of the civil rights organizer Bayard Rustin, who organized the 1963 March on Washington. He was himself an unapologetic homosexual man, was arrested a number of times. He introduces Dr. King and other people to a nonviolent protest as a peace activist, but he has to take a back seat in the civil rights movement because he's a homosexual. He suffered prejudice within the civil rights movement. So those are sort of three historical examples that I think call into question the assertion that there is no meaningful connection to be made between those civil rights movements.
All right. 297-5633-877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. The guest is Dr. Alicia Long from Louisiana State University, history professor at the Old War School for the past 7 years, and we can talk about the historical perspective, which we will, but also what does this mean right now? It was Martin Luther King, who you mentioned, who said that the arc of history bends toward justice. Yesterday, eight people went against what presumably is a scientific poll, and I think it is, from the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. 62% of the people in the community were in favor of this, and yet 67% of the council voted against it. So is there a disconnect?
Well, I mean, in terms of numbers, there's a disconnect, but I mean, there are always very powerful voices in a community, and sometimes they're in the minority view, but they tend to have influence that goes beyond their numbers. And certainly, Louisiana Family Forum, for instance, is a very powerful voice, both in state politics and apparently in municipal politics. And so I think that certainly is at issue.
297-5633, the gentleman who heads the Family Forum, Gene Mills, was, of course, gleeful about the victory for his side yesterday, and he said that John Delgado, who was leading the charge to get this passed, owes an apology because he labeled people who disagree with him as prejudiced, and according to Mr. Mills, or Reverend Mills, he says that's not beneficial, that's not the spirit of this debate, and Delgado, quoted in The Advocate today, said he would apologize when hell freezes over. The battle lines are drawn, and this is an issue that will not go away. It'll come back up maybe a year from now, 2 years from now. There may be some new council members. Actually, four votes was considered by some to be a move in the right direction. Donna Collins Lewis was one who is a bit of a surprise, voted in favor of the ordinance. So they're three votes away, the proponents are. Baton Rouge will be talking about this for many moons to come, and we'll be talking about it in our final segment with Dr. Alicia Long. What do you think? What does this mean for our city, if anything? 297-5633 outside the area, 877-217-5757. Back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF.
This will be the day that I die. This will be the day that I die.
Miss America, pie, dough, machete to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. We resume our discussion with Dr. Alicia Long from the LSU History Department, and we're commenting on the historical background, significance, and what is contemporarily an issue today regarding the 8-4 vote against a fairness ordinance in Baton Rouge that would have protected people of all races, creeds, colors, and those who have different sexual orientations against being kicked out of their homes or losing their jobs as a result of their distinction. And the Metro Council voted 8-4 against this. It was termed by Gene Mills as the Homosexual Affirmation Ordinance, and 8 members of the council sided with Gene Mills, as did most of the state legislature during the last session when Mr. Mills successfully led a charge to keep an unconstitutional sodomy law on the books in Louisiana. David in Mid-City. Good morning, David. You're on the air with Dr. Long.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Forgive me if I misspeak because I get worked up about this issue. But I think something that people need to remember when talking about the civil rights movement in comparison to the movement for LGBT equality is that a lot of the negative effects that are experienced by LGBT community members are experienced more so by people of color and other minorities. So if you're going to be pro-LGBT, you have to be anti-racist. If you're going to be anti-racist, you should really be working on pro-LGBT issues. Thank you so much.
All right. Do you have any response to David in Mid-City?
Well, I mean, I think we were in agreement, basically, about the point that he was making. But, of course, my point was a historical one. And, you know, the vote yesterday, I think, reflects that this movement will take time in southern states. And as I told you, in reading newspapers from the 1960s, you see things about anti-homosexual movements. At the same time, the legislature is very concerned about beating back integration. And there was a lot of energy and political capital devoted to that. I think ultimately, in the end, it was wasted.
In 1956, the Louisiana legislature passed a law signed by Governor Earl Long that prohibited whites and blacks from congregating in public places together. That's just 58 years ago.
And that had certainly been observed de jure, day to day, in and out as well. So the state legislature often sort of piles on.
Okay. Billy Gibson writes, the vote discrepancy is due to the fact that a minority of citizens don't vote. Politicians know this and only have to appeal to their radical bases of support to stay in power.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the comparison between the advocacy of the Louisiana Family Forum and Sharia law was an unfortunate and inaccurate one, but I do think they wield a lot of power, and the survey that you mentioned would suggest that there's a much broader range of public support for the Fairness Ordinance, and so there is something to be said for the observation of the person who wrote in.
297-5633, and I would guess if you would ask most of the 8 members who voted against it, Trey Welch, Shauna Banks Daniel, Scott Wilson, Ronnie Edwards, Buddy Amoroso, Joel Bowie, and Tara Wicker, and Ryan Heck, they would say they're voting as they believe. I don't think one of them would say, I'm voting this way because my constituents want me to. They're voting that because they believe it.
Well, beliefs are beliefs, and legal rights are legal rights. And, you know, one of the things that was mentioned yesterday is that there's no legal basis for this ordinance. But if you look at the 1974 state constitution, it guarantees citizens privacy in their homes. And so on a certain respect, that fairness ordinance really reflects the spirit of the civil rights legislation written into the 1974 state constitution. So there is, in fact, legal grounding for passing something like that fairness ordinance.
Well, over 200 cities in America have passed an ordinance of this kind, including Louisiana's Shreveport and New Orleans. Lauren at LSU. Lauren, good morning. You're on with Dr. Long.
Hey, good morning, Jim. I'm a graduate student at LSU, and I know that a lot of policymakers here in Baton Rouge listen to your show, and I would just like to let them know that these kind of decisions are the reason why I don't know a single graduate student at LSU who came from out of state that wants to stay in Baton Rouge. I just don't understand what the city thinks they're gaining from this. There's nothing to gain. I mean, all I can see is that we're going to lose intelligent people, we're going to lose business, and make it an uncomfortable place to live. But thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. I think Lauren probably is on to something, that this is not a good sales pitch for people in other parts of the country who wish to come here. Most people in other parts of the country, if 62% of the people in Baton Rouge support this, you can bet that in other parts of the country, the majority is even more distinct. And if you got an option to go somewhere else, this might be one more reason to leave.
It might be. I think people try to go places where there are policies friendlier to themselves. But I would say if you're a supporter of the fairness ordinance, I think it's very positive that the business community has gotten behind it. Generally, when change is made in Louisiana, profound social change, it's because the business community gets behind it. And so I think that's a very profound part of this debate and will be going mm-hmm. forward.
The business community was behind it. The mayor was behind it. The governor didn't say a word about it. My guess is that he was against it based on his politics. And my guess is that Congressman Cassidy was against it. And most of the people elected to office today are conservative Republicans. And if they're asked about this, as I think they should, my guess is that most of them would agree with the eight people who voted no yesterday. But three of those eight are African-American Democrats. How do you explain that?
Well, I think people take on particular policy positions because they believe they are right, or because it's matters of faith or personal belief. They feel like they are right. I don't think someone's race should be operative in determining how they would vote on any particular issue. I guess I would say that gay people in New Orleans, for instance, gained tolerance and respect over time because they insisted on it and demanded it and made themselves public. And so I think there's a lesson there in terms of the gay community and their allies in Baton Rouge, in terms of being visible, speaking up, making themselves seen and heard. And that's certainly what contributed to a sort of greater public presence and tolerance for gay people in New Orleans. It didn't just come out of the ether. It's something they fought mm-hmm. for.
297-5633 for Dr. Alicia Long, history professor at Louisiana State University and an authority on race in this country, the author of The Great Southern Babylon, Sex, Race, and Respectability in New Orleans. And you, for many years, lived in New Orleans, commuted to Baton Rouge. You now live here. Are you pleased with your decision?
I am. I'm pleased that I won't be commuting so many days a week, but I think it's a good time to move into Baton Rouge. It's a community with a lot of really positive aspects, a lot of interesting and exciting things going on. And, I'll probably keep a foot in both cities, but I'm proud to be a new resident of Baton Rouge.
Well, as far as life going on, things aren't going to stop because of this vote. And it was not a shock that the council voted as it did. And my guess is that sometime in the next decade, there will be a vote that is different than the one that happened yesterday. But in the interim, what does this mean for artistic people and other people? Big business, IBM, does it mean anything as far as whether or not they're satisfied with the quality of life in Baton Rouge and whether a company would want to locate here?
Well, it certainly, as gay marriage becomes more widely legal, gay couples will have to make decisions about whether to stay in Louisiana or come to Louisiana, and those decisions will impinge upon businesses. And I think our young people have a really different set of beliefs than people in older generations about racial issues and issues of sexual orientation. And so I think on some level that change will be generational, that we are headed that direction. It might just be that federal court decisions press the issue in very conservative places. But I think certainly the writing is on the wall in terms of law.
Dr. Alicia Long is with us for a few more minutes. Reginald in South Baton Rouge, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
This is Dr. Reverend Fitcher. How are you?
I'm doing great. Just appreciate the discussion this morning. Just had a question for your guest. So first of all, it is a civil rights issue, regardless of whether or not we want to accept it as such. It is. But I just have a question for your guest. And dealing with this situation personally, I think the sexual orientation versus the human rights is what's clouding the issue. Because a lot of people I talk to are more tuned into the sexual orientation, the homosexuality, as opposed to the human rights aspect of the situation. And until that's properly articulated and separated, we're going to have this same issue. You know, it's a civil rights issue, but they're making it into a moral issue, which clouds the humanistic or the human rights side of the issue. So I would like to guess, if she could, to comment on that.
Well, I'm not sure I see the distinction between civil rights, because they're embedded in ideas about human rights, about the basic dignity of individual human beings, regardless mm-hmm. of race or sexual orientation. So if there was a distinction being made that I misunderstood, I'm sorry, but I think they are deeply related to one another, and it would be difficult to disentangle them.
I think Reverend Pitcher would agree with you. I think what he's saying, though, is that, as we saw in the open discussion 3 weeks ago, the opponents or fighting this on a religious basis and fighting it because they believe that homosexuality is a sin, and the act of homosexual conduct, in their view, is a sin. And they're not going to embrace something that is against their religious persuasion.
Well, I don't think they're being asked to embrace it. I mean, I think they're being asked to follow the law as regards public accommodation and employment.
Right, but I don't think that's what, I think that's what Reginald Pitcher was getting at. They're not viewing it that way. They're viewing it as a vote against their personal religious persuasion.
But certainly, if I read the letter on that was pro the Be Fair ordinance, there were many people of faith and many faith communities mm-hmm. in Baton Rouge that do support the ordinance. So not all religious people agree, and not all religious people are evangelical.
That is
Protestants.
True. But there are enough in our community, and mind you, three of the five black members voted against it. There are enough that this has been portrayed in a way that is not palatable to two-thirds of the council. And I can understand some of the statements made, because there has been racial discrimination in this city for years, and nobody said a word. For example, when the pool at City Park was bricked up because the city fathers did not want blacks and whites to swim together. Some of these same people who are speaking out now saying this is horrible, they were around, they were alive in 1970. Where were they then? Why weren't they talking about racial discrimination then with the same passion they're talking about discrimination against gay people?
Well, I suspect
today,
if you're talking about LGBT people during that period of time, their behavior as LGBT people was illegal. I mean, they could be arrested on a number of bases just beyond crimes against nature, and so it was very dangerous and difficult for them to speak up during that period of time, and arguably until 2003, Lawrence v. Texas at the U.S. Supreme Court level. So, you know, yes, basic human dignity ought to be respected, but, you know, historical processes take different periods of time.
All right. Paul Annopoulos. Paul, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Long. Hi, Paul.
How you doing, Jeff? How you doing? It is sad that they went against that, but just basic criminal law or wrongfulness. I work at a plant. Plant has a code of fair hiring, which does include non-discrimination for sexual orientation. So if a person was not hired for their sexual orientation, they could right now today sue that company, regardless of what ordinance was passed in the Baton Rouge area. So legally, it's already illegal for it to happen. And my thing to the council is that they basically just would be following what's common practice in most companies today.
Right. Well, I mean, I do think there's, again, precedent within the state constitution for protecting LGBT people, and we should pay attention to that. And so I don't think the Be Fair ordinance was in any way an outrageous overreach as it was portrayed by its opponents. I think it reflects certainly the spirit of the constitution, and as you say, the kind of spirit of fairness that pervades many private businesses.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are places in Baton Rouge where black people can still not go. And there are places where black people, gay or straight, cannot live in this city. And country clubs, which have prohibitions against black people joining. There's a lot of work to be done, not only on the front that we've been talking about here, involving rights for people of all sexual orientations, but certainly the issue about rights for African Americans, it has not been put aside.
No, I think the fight for equality, social equality, political and economic equality is an ongoing one. Despite the fact that we have an African-American president, we have not achieved equality in the United States, as events in just outside St. Louis might remind us. So we have to keep working for people, for people who are interested in human dignity and equality. There's lots of work always to be done.
And a observation from a listener, Shannon, says, could Mayor Holden, who is black, have been elected if he was gay, if he were gay? I don't think he could have been if he were openly gay.
If he were openly gay, I think that would have been difficult. But, you know, in the 60s, there was a former state secretary who was actually rumored to be homosexual, and he had state office and was forced out of it. So it's, you know, there are precedents, historical precedents we ought to look at.
Well, we will see how this goes, but it is an issue not going away.
No, sir, it's not, and I appreciate you letting me speak
well,
to the historical
issues today. Well, I look forward to talking
today
with you again, and Dr. Long is an expert on various topics and is writing a book about none other than Clay Shaw.
That's correct, and that's where my research on LGBT people in the state really comes from. He was, in fact, and he was closeted for very good reasons at the time. There was a climate of hostility, active climate of hostility and legal hostility toward gay people, and it's part of why he was chosen for prosecution. He was legally vulnerable.
And I thought that Tommy Lee Jones' portrayal of him in JFK was inappropriate. He played him as an extremely effeminate person, which he was not.
He was not.
And
but it has to do with a kind of latent homophobia in our culture, and I think that portrayal certainly reflects that, and that was in the early 1990s.
It was in the early 1990s, just over 20 years ago. I wonder if 20 years from now we'll have a fairness ordinance in our fair or not so fair city, as Fred at Louis said this morning.
We shall see.
Thank you, Dr. Long.
Thank
we
you
shall
for having me.
Be back Monday. I'll be back. Jim Nickel hosts tomorrow, and he's got some good guests. Tom Shedler, Secretary of State, is going to be here along with Charlie Cook. Until then, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at wrkf.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.